Welcome, everyone. We have Dewey Day today and a couple of other bills. We will start today by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 227. And Council, would you review the bill itself and the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 227 relates to driving under the influence of intoxicants. ORS 813.010 provides essentially two ways that the state can prove a Dewey charge by alcohol. First, if the defendant has 0.08 blood alcohol content or greater, in which case the defendant is automatically considered to be under the influence. Or the second way, then, is if the defendant is, quote, under the influence of alcohol, and that's regardless of a person's blood alcohol content, or say if the person refused to take a breath test, nonetheless, the state would show that the person was under the influence of alcohol to a, quote, noticeable or perceptible degree. Senate Bill 227 adds a different possibility in situations when a defendant has a prior Dewey conviction or Dewey diversion program completion in the 15 years prior to the incident. In such cases, the defendant would automatically be guilty of Dewey if the defendant's blood alcohol content was a .05 or greater, as opposed to the .08 standard. Senate Bill 227 then applies this standard throughout Oregon statutes relating to driving while suspended, license suspensions, etc. In addition, Senate Bill 227 amends ORS 676.260 to require that medical providers notify law enforcement if the provider reasonably believes that a patient was involved in a motor vehicle accident and has any discernible amount of alcohol in the patient's blood. Present law only requires notification if the blood alcohol content is at or in excess of .08. And then there's the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 227. What the Dash 1 amendment does is it changes that .05 standard that I spoke about to a .01 standard. So essentially any alcohol in the system.
Okay, and before we get started here, when I first saw this bill, I was not interested in scheduling a public hearing on moving from .08 to .05 because this bill refers basically to three-time losers in the drunk driving arena. And I thought, you know, telling someone that, you know, .05 was okay but .08 wasn't did not reflect the realities of someone with a serious drinking problem. But I was willing to have and am willing to have a discussion of basically going to zero tolerance for three-time losers in the drunk driving arena. So we will be focusing the discussion on the Dash 1 amendment, the .01 standard. And .01, I've been convinced, is basically a zero-tolerance standard because it takes into account someone who might have rum cake for dessert or something like that. So anyway, with that, we will start.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Could I ask for clarification?
Sure.
The staff measure summary and my very brief reading of the, I look at this as a second time violation would be the .01 or .05, whichever bill is drafted. And you just said three time losers.
I believe, maybe I misunderstood, it's been a while since I've looked at this bill. The way it was presented to me initially, and you may have a good point here, is that this was for the second conviction. Council, can you help us on that?
Chair Burdick, Senator Barr, this would be for the second conviction, but the way that the statute, or the way that the bill is presently phrased, if you have, I'll just quote, it would also include participation in a diversion program. So if you have a diversion, then you would be subject to the zero tolerance, or if you have a prior conviction, you would be subject to the zero tolerance.
So if you went through diversion and was successful, then you had another DUI, and at that point you would be measured on the new level? So
yeah.
No convictions?
Yeah, no, and that was not my intent.
Correct.
My intent was the second conviction, which assumed an earlier diversion. So if we do anything with this bill, it would not be my intent to invoke this zero tolerance for someone who had successfully completed diversion.
Okay.
And never convicted.
And never convicted, correct.
And just for clarification, but the diversion would count if diversion plus another conviction.
Then it would go
then
into
it would
effect.
Count.
Then it would go into effect.
Thank you.
Okay. But I agree with you, Senator Byer. That's not what it does at the moment. So, but we'll pretend it does, and we will call our Mr. Cruz, please. We need some senatorial decorum here.
I will see if I can find some.
We'll have Chuck Hayes, Vanita Howard, and Kevin Grant.
Good afternoon. My name is Chuck Hayes, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Governor's Advisory on Committee on DUII, and I'm here with two of our other members, and I'll just quickly introduce them, and then they'll introduce themselves.
Mr. Grant, before you get started, we have Senator Monroe just came into the room, and so I'm wondering if we could let him go, because I know he has another committee.
I would be pleased to do that.
If we could let him testify first.
Thank you.
This issue is near and dear to his heart. Welcome, Senator Monroe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rod Monroe, State Senate District 24. I hate booting out my friends.
Before you get started, Senator Monroe, I just explained to the group that my interest is after someone has a conviction, which presumably was preceded by a diversion. So on the third. This would apply to basically the third drunk driving incident. The bill says 0.05 would be the standard. My interest for discussion is a zero tolerance, which would be basically 0.01. So we have a -1 amendment doing 0.01, and that's where I wanted the discussion to focus.
Okay, well, first of all, I've been involved in this issue for a long time. I spent 20 years on the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI and am the author of the omnibus DUI bill that passed in 1983 that basically is still the structure of drunk driving enforcement in the state. Unfortunately, with the loss of state troopers, we no longer have the level of enforcement that we once had. Things are actually getting worse. What we found is that when the law was changed in 1983, it had a dramatic effect on social drinkers, but it has not made a dent in the problem of chronic drunk drivers, alcoholics who continue to drink and drive. And really, you need to come down harder on them. I would prefer if we would have a beverage tax, perhaps, and create a minimum or a medium security facility and lock them up in treatment for 6 months. Maybe they could really get dried out that way, but that hasn't happened. So what this bill does is it says, you know, if you're a third-time loser, and this often means a four-time because they probably went diversion the first time and then three more times, then the blood alcohol, you've proven that you haven't got your problem solved, and the blood alcohol should be lowered to 0.05 or 0.01 or, you know, whatever the committee decides on. The problem is, as we all know, of all of the classes of criminals in our society, the ones with the greatest danger to life and limb for each one of us are drunk drivers by far. Drunk drivers kill and maim more people than all other classes of criminals put together. And so, and yet we keep tending to kind of wink at this and not calling it a crime or not a serious crime. The other thing you need to be aware of is that 80 to 90% of chronic drunk drivers are involved in other illegal activities as well. They're not good people. They don't just drink and drive, but they are involved in other kinds of misdemeanors and sometimes felonies. And so treating them with a pat on the hand is simply not appropriate. Any way you can toughen our drunk driving laws, I will support. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Monroe. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Oh,
this
Senator
question,
Cruz.
Yeah, Senator Monroe, I appreciate this. So, I mean, the discussion we had earlier, were you assuming this was a three-strike policy?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'll have our...
Call me back when you get to, what is it, 8:10?
Okay. So noted. Where can you... just tell our clerk where he can be reached.
Allison's back there. She'll come and get me.
Okay, perfect. We'll take that off our plate. Thank you for your understanding and patience. Welcome back.
You're welcome. Again, my name is Chuck Hayes, and I am the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, and I have two of our members here today as well that will be testifying. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 227, which would reduce the blood alcohol level and establish stronger sanctions for repeat offenders in Oregon. As was just mentioned by Senator Monroe, the DUI repeat offenders are a problem. They're kind of stubborn and persistent, obviously deadly threats on our roadways today. In Oregon, we arrest about 25,000 people each year for driving under the influence of intoxicants. And approximately one-third of those people arrested have been arrested prior for DUI. And so therefore it does create a problem that we're starting to see more people arrested and repeat offenders. Under Senate Bill 227, it would reduce the allowable blood alcohol level from that 0.08 to, as the amendment indicates, a 0.01% for offenders who have a previous diversion conviction anywhere in the United States within a 15-year time period. This concept that we're looking at for Senate Bill 227 is nothing new. In fact, we really took a look at the state of Maine. In 1988, Maine took a dramatic step to deal with their repeat offender problem when they adopted a 0.05 blood alcohol level there for convicted DUI offenders. Well, the first 6 years that that law was in place in Maine, they actually saw a 25% reduction in fatalities involving repeat offenders in the state of Maine, while everywhere else around them in the Northeast, all of the other states actually saw an increase in fatalities involving repeat offenders, but yet Maine had a 25% reduction. Living on that and looking at that success, Maine then in 1995 adopted a zero tolerance, much like has been mentioned today with the amendment for convicted DUI offenders, making it illegal to drive with any measurable amount of alcohol in their system. And Maine, again, is showing significant progress when it comes to the reduction in traffic-related fatalities that involve repeat DUI offenders under the influence. So like Maine and many other states, Oregon has a problem with repeat DUI offenders. We do believe that repeat DUI offenders require additional sanctions and treatment that the normal DUI sanctions cannot provide. We need to send a strong message to people in Oregon about the problem with repeat DUI offenses. We feel like the passage of this bill would also assist in identifying problem drinkers, those who may require additional treatment that, again, because we're talking about many times the hardcore offender. Currently, there are 38 states that have adopted some type of law that deals with repeat DUI offenders. Of the 12 states, Oregon is one of those that has not. So we feel that it is time to look at something such as Senate Bill 227 that would assist Oregon in keeping repeat offenders off our roadways, help identify those problem offenders, which will ultimately save lives in the state of Oregon. That is concludes my testimony, so I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, or I can turn it over to Benita and Kevin.
Do you have a preference for 0.05 versus 0.010 tolerance?
Chair Burdick, I do not. I just feel like that the 0.01 is a standard that has shown that it is working in the state of Maine, and I know that other states have actually attempted this but have not been successful. So, yes, I think that putting that message is a strong message, and I think it is something that is very workable.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Howard. Long time no see.
Senator, I just can't break the habit, I guess. I'm Vanita Howard, and I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. And our goal in Senate Bill 227 is really quite simple. We want to send a very strong message to people that I call perhaps the slow learners who haven't gotten the message that drinking and driving on our highways is unacceptable behavior. The bill also proposes a change in that count period from 10 years to 15 years, which seems to be a far more realistic term to count prior activities. I think we need to keep in mind that we're really not breaking entirely new ground here. Whether the bill is 0.05 for the repeat offender or 0.01 for the repeat offender, Oregon already has on the books a law that says under the implied consent law, there is a zero tolerance level for those who are under 21 years of age. So that's pretty tough for just the young driver. Commercial drivers in Oregon, and I think I'm correct in saying nationwide, the level is 0.04. And the consequences for driving under the influence for a commercial driver are much more severe all the way through than for the normal everyday driver. If we have zero tolerance for the young and the presumably inexperienced drivers and inexperienced drinkers, then why are we so generous with the repeat offender who has had more than one opportunity to understand the seriousness of this offense? If we recognize that a commercial driver needs to be held to a higher standard for staying sober behind the wheel, then why shouldn't we place a higher standard on those who, by their prior actions, have proven to have a disregard for the safety of others? We think that passage of Senate Bill 227, in whatever state it comes out, 05, 01, would be another tool to help convince the repeat hardcore drinking driver that they have a problem and that they must resolve their drinking problem before they can again legally drive on Oregon streets and highways. I've attached, I just encountered this week a study that was reported in the Journal of Safety Research about what is happening in other countries of the world about lowering the BACs for drivers. So this is not something that's totally revolutionary. It's, in fact, this country may be behind in many respects. That concludes my testimony. I just think it's time that we deal more harshly with those who repeatedly drive on the highways under the influence. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Hello, good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Grant, and I am also on the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. I just want to clarify that in Oregon, anybody can get a DUI conviction with any amount of alcohol in their bloodstream. However, to give citizens some kind of a criteria, a quantitative criteria, we have 0.08 as our standard for normal drivers without a prior conviction, of course. Or actually anybody, as of the laws right now. It is, however, difficult to objectively measure your own BAC, considering that you are under the influence as soon as you have any alcohol. But there are various charts online, I don't know if anyone has seen those, that can tell you, based on your gender and your weight, what your BAC is likely to be after so many drinks and after so much time. For example, a male of the average weight of 180 to 200 pounds will be at a 0.08 or above in an hour with about five or six drinks. A female of about 150 to 170 pounds, about three or four drinks, I believe. Make sure that's right. I don't think I'm the only one who believes that having four to six drinks in an hour or five to six drinks in a couple hours doesn't affect you. You can go online anytime and take a look at what your how many drinks it would take for each of you to get to 0.08 and to see how it feels. It might even make you realize that maybe we should have a lower standard in Oregon once sobered up. The Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI strongly believes that the limit should be reduced for repeat offenders. And I do want to clarify that even if you do get a diversion, And if you do go into a diversion agreement, this should still apply to you on your next arrest. I myself actually have received a DUI. It was 3.5 years ago, and I did go through diversion, and it was very successful for me. I really changed around my life, and here I am now advocating for this. So this law would actually affect me, because in the last 15 years I have received a diversion. In fact, I think if I were to receive a DUI in the next 11 or 12 years, I should be held to a much higher, or sorry, lower standard, I guess, because I've gone through treatment. I've seen what driving under influence can do. I've seen what it was doing to me and what it could have done to many people on the road. So I really don't think that this is too much to ask for repeat offenders. And as Anita and Chuck have both mentioned, it sets a standard and it sets a message to Oregonians to be extra vigilant, especially if you've already gotten a conviction or gone through diversion, to monitor your blood alcohol content and really don't take any chances. And hopefully, especially for those people who have gone through diversion, hopefully then their treatment will not be in vain. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, you said that we can't check our blood alcohol content. What we could go online and find out our average weight. Well, most of us don't want to admit what our weight is, and I haven't been on a scale in a while since I've been in session, but this isn't something that I actually talked to OLCC about, because I think people are going to be afraid to even drink in a bar because they're not sure how many drinks they've had. They should be able to be sure how many drinks they've had. Let me state that. If they don't know that, they're in trouble. But they're not going to know. It varies if you've had something to eat, what your weight is, those kinds of things, how much alcohol, what kind of alcohol you're drinking. So my suggestion to the OLCC was, why don't you have these devices, they make portable ones, that are available in bars and taverns so that people can check their blood alcohol content before they even think about walking out and getting behind the wheel, because they may not think they are under the influence. So what would you have to say about that?
Well, Senator Burdick and Senator Walker, I think that's a good idea if we could do that. The charts are really just a guide. You're right, a lot of things like food can impact you. But it does give you a reasonably good idea, because we can't always base it on just subjective feelings, because by the time you've already reached the point where you shouldn't be driving, you're probably already reaching the point saying, oh, maybe it's okay for me to drive. That would be an excellent solution. It would actually at least get people to know what their BAC is before they leave the bar.
Madam Chair, I just think it's an education deal here too. We shouldn't be afraid to go out and have a glass of wine with someone after work or out for an evening, and then be afraid we're at 0.08. We don't know we're at 0.08. We don't know where we're at. But if you've had two glasses of wine, you didn't have any dinner, maybe you're thinking, I'm not sure. I just don't see why we can't help educate the public and make them more aware of how much alcohol they're taking in when they're going out for a little bit after work.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I think education goes hand in hand with treatment and with enforcement. Definitely.
Thank you.
Could I add something, Chair Burdick?
Sure.
To Senator Walker's comment about the devices, this has actually been looked at in a number of states, and right now, just unfortunately, the technology is not quite there, and someday it may be there, but they've actually tried some devices in Colorado and a few other states. In my position, I'm retired law enforcement with the Oregon State Police, and now I work for a federal law enforcement training facility and coordinate their impaired driving program, so I kind of know what all 50 states are doing, and some of these devices have been tested in bars and taverns, but they are found to just not be as accurate as we would like them. And so I think the fear is that a patron will test on one of these devices and it says I'm only a 0.02 or an 0.03, and then they go out and drive and then something happens where they're involved in a crash or maybe the blood alcohol level was actually higher. So those are some of the issues, but I do think that we are moving in that direction. We're just not quite there yet.
I think, Madam Chair, that was the response that I got back from OLCC, if I remember correctly. And it's too bad. I hope it catches up to us soon, because we just need to be more aware of those things. I mean, you could have a two-hour dinner with someone and not realize that you'd had three glasses of wine when the waiter comes and keeps pouring the wine in your glass between all of you at the table, and then you realize, oh my goodness, I had three glasses and I only wanted two. So I just think we need to be more aware.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I agree with that, and I think the technology will get there. We're just not got there yet, so it's going to be soon, hopefully.
Okay, thank you.
But you consider the charts a fairly good guide for most people? Because what struck me about those charts is that how fast you have to drink so much, and you know, and how dependent it is on weight and so on.
Well, Chair Burdick, I've used those charts as being an instructor and conducting many alcohol workshops where we actually dose up volunteers for law enforcement and then put them through the field sobriety test. Those charts are just really kind of an average guide, because I have seen many times where someone can consume more than what the chart may say, and it's, as Kevin talked about, it really is dependent upon maybe how much they've had to drink, what condition they're in, both physically and then also medically. People that are taking prescription drugs along with these things, then you can get a kind of an additive effect. So it's just a guide, really, and it really comes down to as to whether or not the person is impaired. That's the issue.
Right. And of course, you can charge someone and convict someone on drunk driving with less than 0.08 if you can show the impairment.
That is correct, Senator Burdick. Yes.
Right. Ms. Howard.
Senator, just one other comment in response to the question, and that is that some people have a higher tolerance to the alcohol than others, again, because of their basic condition. I also think that we need to keep in mind that this bill is talking about the drivers who probably have a very high tolerance,
right, mm-hmm,
because they've been there and done that, not once, but many times before. I facetiously put into my testimony that probably they wake up in the morning at 05. Many times, they don't know what it is to be sober.
Well, and that's why I wanted to go to zero tolerance, because I think that's the message that needs to be sent to people who clearly have shown that they have a problem. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will have Troy Costellas. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Council Stanford. My name is Troy Costellas. I'm the manager of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I wanted to put in just a little bit of context some of the numbers that were shared by Senator Monroe and the panel that preceded me. The 25,000 DUI arrests that occur in the state every year basically means 87 times a day a dangerous driver is removed from roads and streets of the state dealing with being under the influence of intoxicants. And of those 87, approximately 25 have been in that situation before. It's 25 every day that law enforcement is removing from the streets. The book that is attached to part of my testimony has a set of data. It's 11, 12 years worth of data statewide as well as by individual county. So if you are interested in finding out what's the potential impact of who we're speaking about statewide or potentially within particular counties, you can look. And on line 3A of every page tells you how many arrests there were by the last 11 years in that particular area. And lines 6C and 6D tell you how many of those people are second offenders or third plus. The intent of this bill is all about the future impact. The idea behind the concept of this bill is to change the culture of what it means to be a repeat DUI offender in this state. The expectation and the behaviors of someone that's been through treatment, been through evaluation, very often been through court proceedings, if not been through oversight in relationship to dealing with diversion. One thing I would point out is in the past, there have been confusion about what diversion means. Diversion does include evaluation, does include treatment, as well as on the conviction side. So people that are going through diversion aren't getting a pass on being evaluated and having some sort of instruction, some sort of training. Everybody that we're talking about under this bill, be it the second or potentially third time through, these are people that have had the chance to use the education to put it into place and should know better than being behind the wheel of a vehicle, potentially dangerous to themselves and people around them. Last year, 175 approximately people died in alcohol-related crashes within the state, and a fair percentage of those were people that have been through the DUI process as a diversion or as a convictee prior. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, and I do have department support for Senate Bill 227.
Thank you very much. Isn't it correct, though, that most of the people who get picked up on repeat drunk driving are way higher than 0.08 or 0.05 or any of the stuff we're talking about?
Madam Chair, the average BAC typically fluctuates between 0.15 and 0.17 for the DUI arrests around the state.
For all arrests or repeat?
Madam Chair, for all arrests.
Okay.
And there are two ways to address DUI within the state, and that is those that have been through and had a chance to be educated and have gone through that side, setting an expectation on them, and then there's another, which is those that are choosing to disregard and are more than double the state limit, and what's involved in those, which are the high-end offenders, which is a whole different category and a whole different approach. But now you're talking about wanting to look at some things that are probably intensive for their education and involvement, and somewhat what Senator Monroe had talked about, dealing with them in a much different fashion than we have done on the routine program that's out there, because that's a different class of offender, different from what this bill's addressing.
Okay, thank you. Good questions? Thank you, Troy.
Thank you.
Okay, Tim Martinez and Jim Anderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. Mr. Anderson signed us up. I know he meant to say no position instead of opposed to this bill. At least speaking for the Oregon Medical Association, we have not yet taken a position on the bill in general. And frankly, we do have a committee meeting tomorrow night, and perhaps between now and then I'll have a chance to talk to your counsel to see whether we're talking, you know, after one diversion or one arrest or three strikes and you're out, to just make it clear what the direction the committee intends to go forward with. Our concern with the bill currently, which I am confident I can speak to, is in Section 6. And in Section 6 of the bill, as introduced, it requires a healthcare provider to notify within 5 calendar days any law enforcement officer or agency any discernible amount. Currently, there are statutes in place that require us to report when it's 0.08 and above. I would tell you that one of the things that we need to do better with law enforcement is to know that these are actually followed up on today. I think Jim will also talk about his emergency room docs, but my members are convinced that a lot of times no action is ever taken. And it does take some additional effort beyond seeing patients to make these reports, which takes time away from providing medical service. So we are concerned about that to begin with. But to do it for any discernible amount, as the bill currently calls for, would really, in our opinion, be a huge burden without any, as far as we can tell under the bill as written, really any benefit except for those limited numbers that would be brought in under the bill. So you have the cost issue, you have the fact that you're taking physicians away from seeing patients, and again, as the bill is written today, the majority of those, no action would be taken by law enforcement. So that's our concern, and we would certainly try to work with the committee and the proponents to see if there's some way to deal with that issue.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Jim Anderson with the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And I sit here before you thoroughly admonished by Mr. Martinez for signing us up as opposition.
Cross it off.
We have, yes, please do. We have a neutral position on this bill also. As a matter of fact, the emergency physicians would stand thoroughly behind the purpose of a bill like this, because there's nothing we like to see more in this state than to reduce the amount of accident victims we see presented to an emergency department on a daily basis. Anything that we can do, anything that we can do to help to pass an issue like this, we would stand firmly behind it. A couple of things, rather than go through and repeat what Mr. Martinez has said, a couple of things I would add to what he had said, and again, it centers around page 8, section 6, any discernible amount. So if you stop and think about what that means to an emergency physician, quite honestly, they would have to report to law enforcement every time they draw blood. Because any discernible amount, if a person has a head cold and takes cough medicine, there is alcohol in the cough medicine, in many cough medicines, some there isn't. There's a lot of non-alcoholic beverages out there that do contain a discernible amount of alcohol. That would test positive. That would be a reportable item. Also, it's asking a physician to know, and they have no way of knowing, if this person is a repeat offender. So therefore, they would default to report everyone. And that's a burden that I'm sure law enforcement doesn't want to have. It's something that takes away from our attention to patient treatment, something we don't want to have. Madam Chair, I would leave it at that and open Mr. Martinez and I to any questions you might have.
Thank you. And in answer to your question, Mr. Martinez, I don't think there's any interest on the committee in invoking this for someone who has simply been through diversion. It would take probably one or two convictions to actual convictions. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Assuming that most people do diversion. Okay, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amy Elkanich.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Elkanich, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and we oppose this bill as it is drafted. And frankly, I'm not 100% sure what this bill will look like when it is readdressed and some of the issues are taken care of. But I do want to discuss some of the primary concerns that I have now. The first thing I'd like to address is Section A, big Section A, and I'll try and keep this brief. It's on the first page of the bill. And in reading this and rereading it, how I read big Section A, which is line 14, and I'll read it out loud, that this addresses somebody who has participated in or was ordered to participate in a driving while under the influence diversion program, or in this state or another jurisdiction, as a result of having been arrested, cited, or charged. Now, the scenario that I envision with this is that this would apply as drafted to somebody who chooses to participate in a program.
Let me just stop you there. This is not something that we're taking seriously in this bill, this section, for the reasons I just gave.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and perhaps I should just say we oppose this bill how it's drafted. If it comes back, I'd like to have the opportunity to reread it and address any concerns we have, since it sounds like some of these issues are going to be resolved, and I don't want to speak to something to take up the committee's time.
And that was your main concern?
That's not my main.
Oh, what was your? Why don't you go on ahead? Okay. I don't want to derail you here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
One of our main concerns is that it's within the 15 years. We believe that that's too narrow of a time period. We have the same concerns with the ER doctors, but I think you've addressed that. We testified against that in the House, and we carry those same concerns into the Senate. We do have a concern about the 0.01 standard, in addition to being an arbitrary number, although I understand it's supposed to be zero tolerance or indicative of a zero tolerance policy. We are concerned that that's, you know, is an arbitrary number, and that judges will use that potentially as some sort of a guidepost for what intoxication is. And I think everyone can agree that we're concerned about people who are driving impaired. And I don't think that there's any way for an individual to self-regulate sufficiently so they don't have a 0.01. And again, we had a concern about the second time loser issue, but I realize that that is not going to be an issue. And my final concern, and this was connecting to 810, which I will only sort of be opposing, but I think this bill needs to go in connection with Senate Bill 810 because this has a statutory counterpart language, and if the statutory counterpart language isn't properly fixed as the amendments that Mr. Bradley suggested, we would object based on those grounds because we think the statutory counterpart language is flawed, inherently flawed as it is now, and I'll talk about that more in Senate Bill 810.
Okay, which happens to be next on our agenda. So, any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
is that
you.
It? Okay. We're skipping around a little bit, so let me just tell you what we're going to do today. We just finished Senate Bill 227, unless there's somebody else here who wants to testify. We're going to go to Senate Bill 810, and then Senate Bill 344, Senate Bill 347, if we have time, and Senate Bill 536. So we will go to Senate Bill 810 now, and I think Senator Monroe wanted to testify on that as well. So, in the meanwhile, let's have counsel summarize.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 810 also relates to driving under the influence of intoxicants law in Oregon. It clarifies the meaning of the term statutory counterpart. Again, ORS 813.010 establishes the elements for Dewey law in Oregon. In short, most Deweys are Class A misdemeanors, unless there's a serious injury to the victims. For a non-serious injury Dewey to rise to the felony level, ORS 813.010 sub 5 requires that the person have three prior Dewey convictions in Oregon or the statutory counterpart in another jurisdiction within 10 years prior to the date of the current offense. Senate Bill 810 relates to this statutory counterpart language. The issue, put simply, is that while all states have Dewey laws, in some cases those laws are considered to be insufficiently similar to Oregon's, such that a Dewey in another state would not count against the person in Oregon. There's a 2005 Oregon Court of Appeals decision which considered whether an Idaho Dewey conviction counted against an Oregon defendant for purposes of felony Dewey. Because Idaho has a special Dewey statute that allows for prosecutions of anyone under 21 years old at 0.03 or greater blood alcohol content, the court held that the Idaho statute was not a statutory counterpart and did not count. And it's my understanding that what being derived from this case, there are judge opinions where Washington, for example, may not require that the Dewey be on a public roadway, and that therefore it's kind of different than Oregon, and therefore the Washington conviction may not count against the defendant in Oregon. So what Senate Bill 810 seeks to do is to replace this statutory counterpart language with, in relevant part, language referring to a conviction from a different jurisdiction involving the use of alcohol while operating a vehicle. It seeks to provide additional clarity. I'll note that the proponents of this bill have suggested amendments to the language as it exists that will hopefully clarify and narrow things.
Okay. We have John Bradley signed up. And if you want to bring somebody, are you Melissa?
Sherelle.
Sherelle. Okay. First appearance here in Senate Judiciary this session, Mr. Bradley. We've missed you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my first and only, hopefully. this is a bill that...
Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm John Bradley. I'm in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm a special counsel to the district attorney, and as several of you know, I've been there forever. I want to just kind of briefly... I think I've been in front of this committee over the years many, many times. This is the first time I think I've ever been here on a driving under the influence bill. This came to my attention about a year ago, in which I sit on the appellate committee in our office, in which we decide whether or not we take appeals where courts make rulings against us. We had a particular judge in Multnomah County who ruled that for all intents and purposes, all convictions out of the state of Washington would not be considered as a statutory counterpart in the state of Oregon. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, that's ridiculous, that, you know, this judge is going to rule that we cannot use Washington convictions to either enhance penalties to felonies or deny people diversion. We took the appeal. The Attorney General's office talked us out of it. Since that time, I've gone back and I've read the case, State versus Ortiz. It's cited in Mr. Shunk's written memorandum. And if you read that case, I have to say that I think that it's really created a lot of confusion when we're talking about out-of-state convictions. Ms. Rowe's here. She can talk a little about her experience, about the challenges to this in virtually every case. Up until 2 years ago, until Ortiz, this was a problem in which we seldom ever saw and was seldom if ever successful. The judges in our county, and I'd say around the state, have been very inconsistent in their rulings because how difficult it is, because other states since 1981, when we adopted the term, have changed their DUII statutes. Some of them are, most of them, I think you'll see on Mr. Shrunk's summary on the second page where it says the problem. It states how the various different states, primarily, how those states are a little bit different. In the state of Washington, it can be on private property. In the state of Washington, instead of having a 0.08 blood alcohol at the time you're driving, it's a 0.08 blood alcohol within 2 hours of driving. Now, obviously, those are not the same, and probably a court would exclude any conviction for having a 0.08 within 2 hours of driving. What we did is that we drafted some legislation and had it introduced, and it was I would say much narrower than the Senate 810 as it exists today. What happened is it went down to this, you know, Legislative Council, they redrafted it, came into its present form, and I have to say I made a mistake in the sense that when it was read to me and I looked at it, I thought, well, that covered everything that we put in there. It was just a different way of doing it. But what I soon came to realize was it was much broader than anything we intended. Arguably, it would capture minor in possession to somebody who was driving a vehicle and had alcohol on them. The other thing is, Mr. Stanford said that the Ortiz case talked about, in that case, the Idaho conviction was not considered because I believe in that case, if you were a juvenile and had blood alcohol over a 0.02, that was a DUI. Our intent is not to capture those juvenile. It was never our intent to capture those juvenile offenses. What we have done, and they're basically on the last three pages of the materials you have, is we have amended Senate Bill 810 to go back to the to our original thought as far as narrowing it, as far as the definition of statutory equivalent or the statutory counterpart. There is one change I've made in there, and if you look at the proposed amendments, if you see, and this is sort of a little bit of a housekeeping thing, it says on page 229 of the bill.
Where are you on the first page of amendments?
I'm on the first page of amendments, okay. And I'm on line 8. Where it says number 8.
Item 8, okay.
Where it says on page 2, line 29, delete the word misdemeanor. Now, in our amendments, we put in lines 27 to 30. So we're putting back the existing statute. The trouble is the existing statute says if somebody was convicted or if the person was convicted of a misdemeanor driving while under the influence in violation of ORS 813, the problem is we can have a situation where someone was convicted of a felony, not a misdemeanor. So you'd have within a 10-year period a conviction of a misdemeanor, and a felony, and the existing law wouldn't cover it. So all I'm saying is I think this is a housekeeping thing. I don't think anybody intended that when they drafted the original bill, but it's just we've had at least, I believe, one judge who've ruled that because someone had a felony as opposed to misdemeanor within that 10-year period. So it's I think it's a minor thing, but I just want to bring it to your attention. You can see how we've excluded anybody who has a breath or blood alcohol content test where it's 21 years of age and it's under the, because they're 21, it's different than had you been over 21. And we've made that to each section. Why don't I, I've taken enough time, why don't I just turn this over to Melissa, and I think she does these things, she's seen them, and if you have any questions, we'll be happy.
Okay, before we do that, Senator Monroe is back, and Senator Monroe, I'll leave it to you as to whether you want to go now or wait till Melissa finishes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll go now since I'm playing hooky from Ways and Means. And my comments will be very brief. This is a bill that
For the record, you need your name.
Rod Monroe, District 24. Yes, shouldn't forget that. this is a bill that I introduced on behalf of Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schrunk, who's been a longtime friend of mine, who's worked with me on these kinds of issues for many, many years. It basically deals with two things. Clarifies, you know, whether out-of-state convictions count, and if so, even though the other state, and usually it's Washington or California, even if the other state has slightly different DUI laws, do they still count? And this bill would say, yes, they should, toward your three strikes and you're out. And the other thing is it clarifies that In the 10-year period, if you have three within 10 years, then it becomes a felony that counts diversion. If you have diversion, as can count as one of those in that 10-year period, because diversion really means that they were caught drunk driving and they opted to divert. They can do that once. It also makes it real clear when a person is eligible for diversion. So if you've had a previous DUI, then you're not eligible for diversion. This bill says even if that previous DUI was in another state, you're not eligible for diversion. That makes sense to me. And of course, I support the narrowing amendments that were just described to you that the district attorney would like to have included. And thank you for hearing this bill. Again, as I said before, DUI is in terms of the impact on our citizens. I mean, we saw 2 days ago a great tragedy where 33 people died in a shooting incident, but we kill hundreds of people every year with drunk drivers. We should treat that just as soberly. I'd be happy to answer questions, and I hope you'll move this bill.
Thank you. We will definitely treat it soberly.
Thank you.
Questions from the Sorry, Senator Monroe. Okay. Thank you for your patience. Melissa, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairperson Burdick, members of the committee. Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to testify on this important bill. My name is Melissa Chereau. I'm a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County and have been a deputy district attorney for 5 years. I'm currently the deputy who's assigned to the felony DUI caseload in our office. And in the past 5 years, I've tried many a misdemeanor and felony DUI. It's only been in the last 2 years that we've seen a massive problem with these prior DUI convictions. If this had been 2 years ago, we might not even be here. 2 years ago was when the Ortiz case came out. And although the problem is recent, it's a very serious problem and seems to be plaguing the county courthouses across this state. Before Ortiz, it just didn't really come up. We had courts who were routinely allowing prior convictions and recognizing them as statutory counterparts and treating offenders accordingly. So a first-time offender would get into diversion, and somebody who had been convicted of three prior convictions in 10 years would be treated as a felony. But starting 2 years ago after Ortiz, it's an enormous problem. In fact, I have no cases on my felony DUI caseload right now where there's a prior DUI conviction from another state that is unchallenged. There just is simply none. In talking with others in our office and in talking with other prosecutors across the state, they are facing the same problem with diversion and felony cases. And when you think that 65 to 70 or 75% of all of the out-of-state convictions that we're talking about are from the neighboring states of California and Washington, This has become a real problem. I've tried these cases. Sometimes our office wins. Sometimes our office loses. Our judges, like other judges across the state, are all over the map. We have judges who are prior prosecutors who are handing down different rulings from one another, judges who are prior public defenders who are ruling differently from one another. I think the best example I can give you is a person who's right now on my caseload. He has 3 prior convictions for DUI in the past 10 years out of the state of California. His attorney is attempting to get him into diversion. In one courtroom, he'll be treated as a felony DUI offender and he won't get diversion. In the very next courtroom, he's treated as a misdemeanor and he gets into diversion. And that's the problem that we're talking about. We're talking about the people who are the most dangerous, the repeat offenders who simply do not belong in diversion. It doesn't make sense to treat people differently depending on what courtroom they're in. And it wastes not only valuable lawyer time, but obviously valuable judicial time. It's our opinion we need to fix something that wasn't a problem 2 years ago. This is an opportunity to clarify what the law has always said and to eliminate unnecessary and costly litigation. Thank you very much, Chair Burdick, for the opportunity and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify. I'm certainly available for any questions you would have.
Thank you. Mr. Bradley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I agree with everything that Senator Monroe said except one, and that is he said that it would somehow make diversions count for the 3 things for a felony. I don't think that's correct. I think maybe it's something I've said or something like that, that he's a little confused on that. But it's not. It would. The only thing it does to diversion is it just says these out-of-state convictions will apply to diversion. Does that clarify things?
Yes. Thank you for clearing the record up.
And the amendments, as I think I've said, are the last 3 pages. Legislative Council have not seen them.
Okay. Well, I'm very interested. He's my district attorney too, and I'm very interested in working with this bill. And so I just want to let you know that we are under very tight deadlines. So that,
I know
that these need to get to Legislative Council, and you can work with Council on that. Are there questions from these witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amy Elkanich.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Amy Elkanich. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I had intended to oppose this bill, and that's how I signed up. But after I had an opportunity to review the proposed amendments, if these amendments were incorporated or substituted into this bill, I think the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association would support it. This is, in our opinion, frankly, a long time coming and very necessary, and it would clear up a lot of litigation on our part as well. And we hope that the committee would be willing to entertain these amendments and work with all parties.
Yeah, it's my understanding. I'm glad to hear you say that. It's my understanding that these amendments were what was intended in the first place. So hopefully we can get this all together and be able to march arm in arm on the Ortiz case.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify? Okay, close the hearing on Senate Bill 810, and we will be bringing it back. And we will open a public hearing on, what did I say next, 344? Senate Bill 344. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 344 relates to the creation of an evidentiary privilege for confidential communications made by minors to parents. Oregon law presently recognizes a number of evidentiary privileges, including but not limited to attorney-client, psychotherapist-patient, physician-patient, nurse-patient, school employee-student, clinical social worker-client, husband-wife, clergy-penitent, counselor-client, stenographer-employer, for Senator Walker's benefit, public officers, and disabled persons' sign language interpreter privileges. Senate Bill 344 adds a privilege for communications from a minor to a parent. Specifically, the bill states that a parent or the parent's child cannot be examined as to any communication made in confidence by the child to the parent, not vice versa. A communication is made in confidence if it is made out of the presence of other persons except for the child's siblings or grandparents living in the same household. The privilege may be claimed by the child, the parent, a guardian or conservator for the child or parent, or the personal representative of the child or parent. There are specific exceptions when the privilege does not apply. Such exceptions include, but are not limited to, certain criminal actions involving the parent or child, civil actions between spouses, and actions involving termination of parental rights.
Okay, this bill was brought to us by our good colleague, Senator Przanski. Why don't you start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4. This matter came to my attention from Charlie Zanashe, who's seated to my left, your right, or directly in front of you. Charlie is a practicing attorney in the Eugene area, has served as a prosecutor in various municipal courts, and is now in private practice and does a lot of multiple type of work. The issue that he brought to my attention, what we're attempting to address, is where you have a child who comes into basically in contact with their parents to get communication from them or to them regarding a situation that may have involved them in some way. To protect that communication as being confidential and it not being required to be, quote-unquote, used against the child and more than likely in a criminal type of proceeding, but it could also be in a civil proceeding. We do understand and expect that there would be exemptions or exceptions to that where we're talking such as child abuse or some type of other wrong that's happening to the child. Basically, what we want to make certain is that we allow for communication in families, to allow the families to actually be there for support and not to have to worry that if your child comes up to you to share with you something that they may find themselves needing to share, that you don't turn around and then have the parent being forced and required to give testimony against that child. I do want to note on the record that DHS has come to has brought to my attention a desire to have an exception built in that would basically allow for juvenile court dependency proceedings under RS Chapter 419B that would include but not limited to actions to terminate the parental rights to be exempted from that. We're more than welcome to work with them to make that happen. They are here if you have any questions. I also understand the Department of Justice has an attorney or two who may be wanting to voice some concerns they may have with the bill. We're not sure exactly what those concerns are, but we're willing to work with them. The premise that we have before you is basically we think it's only fair and it's only right in a parent child relationship that the parent can be confided in by the child. If we don't do that, then we basically have lost the family structure, not allowing the child to be able to have confidence where they need to have guidance and assistance. This is modeled after a law that's in effect in Minnesota, and I'll turn it over to Charlie Zanashe, and we'll return to the dais.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senators, Senator Przanski, thank you. I'm here today mostly as
Would you identify
yourself? Oh, sorry. My name is Charles Zanashe. I live in Eugene, Oregon, and as Senator Przanski said, I'm here in support of the bill. As amended, there's some proposed amendments that are before you, and I am asking you to approve it as amended. I'm a lawyer in Eugene, Oregon, but I'm also the father of three teenagers, and I'm asking that the Oregon law recognize the importance of the parental relationship and the role of parents in guiding their children and as being a resource to their children. Imagine, if you will, some night your child comes home covered with blood, and you ask, "What happened?" The next words your child utters out of his or her mouth could be used against them, and you could be forced to testify against them. That is totally destructive, I believe, to the family relationship. There can be little dispute that frank communication is a hallmark of a solid parent, healthy and trusting parent-child relationship. Studies have indicated that greater communication between children and parent results in children who are less likely to be before the court system. Open communication is essential for parents in order to understand what their children are doing and experiencing and to provide them guidance. Moreover, if a child finds himself in a situation where they have done something wrong and they're in some sort of trouble, who do we want them to turn to for guidance and support? Right now, under the law, a child who goes to their parent to ask for guidance and explain the situation, risks having that parent and those statements to the parent used against them. As the council rep indicated, there are 13 specific privileges currently in Oregon law, embodied in Oregon law. The heart of those privileges is a recognition that some relationships are so important to our society, and frank communication in those relationships is so important to the success of those relationships that they are protected from forced disclosure. Unfortunately, Oregon law doesn't afford that same protection to the parent-child relationship. Ironically, I will point out to you, it does provide that protection for communications that from a child to a teacher. And while I believe that teacher schools are a great resource for children, I think all educators would agree they are not a substitute for parents and parental involvement. Senate Bill 344 is narrowly tailored to prevent having a parent forced to be testify against a child for statements made by a minor child to that parent in confidence. The privilege can be waived by the parent if the parent believes it is in the child's best interest to do so. There are also a number of exceptions. Our goal here is not to hamper protection of parents or other co-children in the family or other protect the children is our goal here in the family unit. It is not to protect that illegal conduct amongst the family members. However, a family should never endure having the parent forced to testify against the child for communications the child has made to the parent. The proposed amendments that you have before you, I think, clarify the bill, and I commend them to you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this, Madam Chair, or Senators.
Thank you. Sometimes the parents hear things that would actually benefit the child. Does the parent get to pick and choose what kind of information they would reveal? You say testify against the child, but does that mean that they would not be able to speak at all, or could they just say the good stuff and not the bad stuff?
I would believe that, this is probably an issue for evidentiary law, but my belief is that if you waive the privilege at all, you waive the privilege. So, but there, I'd have to look at the law around that. The goal here, though, is to leave it to the parent to make the decision as to what's in the best interest of the child rather than the state.
Because it's my understanding that's how it works with the other privileges. So if there was one piece of information that was damaging and a whole bunch of information that was good, then it would be up to the parent to decide whether it was worth waiving the privilege.
That is correct.
In this bill. And the child would have no say in the matter on waiving the privilege.
Well, the child could elect to waive the privilege him or herself, but they couldn't block the parent from waiving the privilege. And again, with the amendments, we're talking about the parent to whom the communication is made, the confidential communication is made. Children in family relationships often have a better relationship with one parent or the other, one they feel more trusting or open to. So it is that parent to whom the communication is made who has the right to waive the privilege.
Okay, I need to go testify on a bill for the moment, so Senator Beyer will be taking over the hearing. My apologies, I shall return.
Any other questions of the witness?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Zanashi, I was just trying to figure out really quickly. I was testifying on another bill as well. It's that time of the session, and so I couldn't figure out why you brought the bill, and I'm reading your material, and it's telling me right now, so I don't think I have a question.
Why did I bring the bill?
Yeah.
I brought the bill because, initially I brought the bill because I attended a CLE presentation at the University of Oregon Law School, which focusing on how the court system and the legal system could better protect parents and parent-child relationships and foster successful relationships. And during that, there was a discussion by a professor regarding how to use constitutional law to argue for a privilege on a case-by-case basis. And it occurred to me then, and I'm a lawyer, that I was surprised that Oregon doesn't have a privilege for children. You know, I've been a lawyer for 20 years now, or 19 years. I was surprised we didn't have that privilege. And I just thought that it's got to be a far better way to resolve this than to have a case-by-case determination as to whether a privilege applies. And creating it legislatively would give people guidance as to what the privilege is when it applies. Now, this privilege was very narrowly tailored, only to cover communications. It is not a general grant of no testimony. A parent would still be liable to testify against a child for conduct that the parent witnesses. It's just for the communications, confidential communications by their child. And just so you know, it's not a totally esoteric or theoretical belief system. Since I have floated this idea, I've been contacted by several different lawyers who have indicated instances that they're aware of where prosecutors have in fact called parents to testify against children for what the statements made by the children.
Could I ask a clarifying question, Mr. Chair?
What, excuse me?
Could I ask another clarifying question? Thank you. Mr. Zanashe, there's a prohibition against spouses testifying against one another in the law currently.
Correct.
And so this is narrower than that prohibition, correct?
This is much narrower. The spousal immunity is twofold. There's a non-testimonial privilege in the spousal privilege that says you can't be forced to testify in a criminal proceeding against a parent or against a spouse, period, regardless of what the source of your information. And then there's a confidential communication privilege. So this is much narrower. This is more along the lines of a confidential communication in a criminal proceeding. We're really trying to be narrow here.
Okay. Great. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. And you spoke of amendments. I just got a copy, and the council just received a copy of the dash one, but I understand there may be another amendment coming from DHS, so we'll have to take a look at that when we get them.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Amy?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Alconich here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we are here in support of this bill. In doing some research, I found that Florida, Idaho, Massachusetts, and Minnesota all have these privileges. Actually, let me rephrase that. Florida is currently moving this bill. It's moved out of the House there. Idaho, Massachusetts, and Minnesota currently have this privilege. In New York, they don't have this privilege, but case law has said that it recognizes the right of a parent to refuse to testify against a child. In our opinion, this bill just makes sense. I mean, we recognize a spousal privilege because we recognize that the trust between those two people should not be violated and should be respected and is vital to honoring the institution of family and marriage. And we should take that same approach when we look at a parent and a child. That relationship is the closest bond and closest tie ever, tighter than marriage, siblings, you know, teacher, child, psychologist, child, attorney, client, although sometimes that's closer than you want it to be. But it's vital that that be recognized and that we put that as a priority and that we do that to encourage open communication between parent and child in the most difficult and sometimes frightening times. I mean, the first person a child is going to go to, we hope and want, is a parent when they're in trouble. And this would encourage that open line of communication. We wholeheartedly support it. We think it's a whole, we think this is direction that other states are going. I'm following Florida to see what happens there, but it looks like it's moving there as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephanie Tuttle and Scott Healy. That's all I have in the list. Does anyone else want to testify and didn't sign up? Okay. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Tuttle. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice. I've been with the Department of Justice for just a couple months now, but prior to that I was in the Marion County District Attorney's Office and have spent close to 14 years now as a prosecutor. The majority of that time was spent prosecuting child abuse crimes. I'm here actually to testify against Senate Bill 344, and I can tell you I'm also the mother of four kids, and would hope that they would come and trust me with important information and problems that they would have in their lives. The problem is, I believe that this particular bill goes beyond what it's intended to go beyond. And it's important to note that there are several privileges in the evidence code, but most of those are based on long-term historical privileges. They also cover confidential communications that are defined slightly differently than this bill. In this bill, the nature of a confidential communication has to do with who's in the room when the disclosure is made. For other currently existing privileges, the issue is the intent of the speaker. A confidential communication is limited to those communications in which the speaker intends them to be confidential. So, for instance, if I'm in my lawyer's office talking about my case, clearly that's intended to be confidential. If I'm out in a public place and talking to my lawyer about something else and I clearly don't intend it to be confidential, there is no privilege there for that communication. Senate Bill 344 does not limit the nature of a confidential communication to only those communications that are clearly intended to be confidential. The other thing that's interesting about the way this bill is written is that most privileges apply to the speaker or the person that's making the communication. This bill actually covers both sides, the child who is making the statement as well as the parent who is hearing the statement, and both sides can assert the privilege. As the bill is written, I'm concerned that it would be interpreted to mean that because the privilege can be claimed by the child or the parent, that in order for it to be waived, it would have to be waived by both the child and the parent in order for that evidence to come into court. I certainly understand the idea that we want parents to be able to make those decisions about, you know, when should what my child tells me remain in confidence and when it shouldn't. I don't believe that this bill gets at that issue. We heard some testimony earlier. What if your son comes home covered in blood and you ask him what happened? I'm not sure that what you really want as a consequence of this bill is to be that the son tells you, I just raped and killed 3 6-year-olds down the street, and now as a parent you're bound to silence, regardless of what you think is the best way to handle that situation. What this bill would do in effect is make it so that you couldn't have consequences for that behavior, at least not based on that statement. You'll see in the written testimony that I provided that I gave a few examples of circumstances that I'm not sure you really want to be protected by this privilege.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Senator Pradowski. Sorry to bother, cut in, Ms. Tuttle, but we also heard testimony from Mr. Zinasche as to dash ones, as to the narrowing of the bill, and it seems like your testimony is on the bill itself, not on what he stated on the record, that it would be waiverable by the parent if the parent chose to do so. I'd like to hear your testimony and your position, if those changes are made, as to the position you or the department would be taking.
Co-Chair Byer, and Senator Pruszynski, and I apologize. I have to be honest with you. I haven't seen those dash one amendments. When I looked them up yesterday, when I looked up the bill, I didn't actually see them. I didn't see them over there.
I understand
there.
That, but you're in the room. I watched everyone in the room today, so we've all heard the same thing. So being an attorney, being a prosecutor for 14 years, I know you can think on your feet. So taking into consideration what you've heard, I'm wondering if your position changes.
Senator Pruszynski, let me try to answer that the best I can. The bill that I have currently written looks like it's intending to get what you're talking about. I don't believe that it does. And the reason I'm having difficulty answering your question directly is, not having seen those amendments, I'm not exactly sure that it would accomplish what you're talking about. But let's say there's language drafted that says the parent on their own can decide to waive that privilege. I would continue to have serious concerns about this bill. And the reason that I say that is, we all, having been parents ourselves and dealt with parents, have this hope that parents are always looking out for the best interest of their kids and the community. That's not always the case. I can tell you, for instance, as a child abuse prosecutor, I was stunned the first time it happened and sadly not surprised the last time when I had a mom who turned their back on a child. Child comes and says, your boyfriend is sexually abusing me. And boyfriend admits to it, mom still takes boyfriend's side. My concern in a situation like this is that initial disclosure to mom, if mom decides, well, We don't want that coming into evidence against boyfriend. Now mom gets to assert that.
But I also understood that, if I could, Mr. Chair, that the testimony from the, Mr. Zanashi's testimony, that would not be privileged. That would be exempted out and would, in fact, be disclosed because it would be an act against the child, and the bill as intended with the amendments would, in fact, require or could require the parent to disclose if he or she were forced into court by a criminal prosecution for the protection of the child because of a crime committed against that child.
And Senator Brzezinski, again, I'm at a disadvantage not having seen those amendments. The bill I have in front of me talks about the child being a victim of a crime, but only the victim of a crime of the actual parent. And, of course, the boyfriend wouldn't be in that role. If what you're talking about doing is broadening this so that when the child is the victim in a case, this privilege would not apply, mm-hmm. I certainly would appreciate that language more than a lot of others. There's another example that I gave in my written testimony that, again, is a concern, and that is where, let's say I've got a 15-year-old gang member who comes home, and we'll use the covered in blood example again, comes home and says, yeah, my fellow gang member just shot somebody. You know, tells mom about that. Mom tries to help him out. Well, later on, that same person goes into court and lies about it in order to get his friend out of trouble. I think, even if my understanding of the current amendments is correct, I think that even under those amendments, mom would not be able to come into court and say, wait a minute, that's not what he told me. What he told me is that he actually saw this. Now, that would be him testifying certainly inconsistently with mom, not necessarily against the child.
Right, and there's ways to go after that for impeachment, as well as what we've already said, is that child doesn't control the waiver, the parent does. The parent has the right, based on what has been put before us today.
Yeah. Senator Brzezinski, I see what you're saying, and I would hope that it would be applied that way. Again, I haven't actually seen the language, but I can tell you that I do have concerns, and as a prosecutor, I have concerns not only about how it would be used, but even how a parent might use it.
Ms. Tuttle, I understand that. My frustration is this is the first time for you to come in and give testimony.
Mm-hmm.
If you maybe worked with me in the sense of telling me what your concerns were, we may have been able to save a little bit of time to make sure you had a little better confidence as to where we're wanting to go. My frustration is also with myself and with Ms. Zanashi putting on the record what we intend to do and how we want to fix it. I'm hearing testimony as to what is not our intent and what we want to go forward on. That's my problem.
Okay, Senator Brzezinski, and I'm sorry about that, and I'd be more than happy to try to work with you or Mr. Zanashi and try to see if we can't come to kind of a common goal. I'm more than happy to do that, and I apologize for any inconvenience.
Okay, how about if we get the testimony from the other witness, and then we know where the bill is going to come back and go with amendments.
Thank you, sir.
And then we'll have let you work with them. Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to be here. My name is Scott Healy. I'm a deputy district attorney from Clackamas County. I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I had planned to talk about, well, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I've been with the Clackamas County DA's office for about 13 and a half years, and for about 10 of those years, a large part of what I've done is prosecute child abuse cases, mostly where the victim's under the age of 12. And I have a long list of things that I was going to testify about, but after hearing Senator Brzezinski talk to Ms. Tuttle, I think that I might just address the issue that you were talking to her about from my perspective. Is that okay?
Yes,
and
please.
Because I was just going to talk about how this particular bill, 344, is not good at all for child prosecution and for a number of reasons, and Ms. Tuttle got into that a little bit. But I guess what I would say is that establishing a privilege is a very significant thing to do in the law. And Ms. Tuttle talked a little bit about the privileges that currently are established, that they're long-standing privileges. Previously we had the OWLA, or the OCDLA, I'm sorry, what's her name?
Amy
testifying. With regard to a few of the other states that have tried to establish this privilege, but that's a very small number of states so far, and that should show you why it's a significant issue with regard to establishing a new privilege. We certainly have constitutional safeguards under the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendment in Article 1, you know, Section 10, 11, and 12 of the Oregon Constitution that already handle a number of these issues. Also, we have a number of statutory provisions and also a number of evidentiary provisions that put judges in the place of basically weighing whether or not testimony should be given or not, whether or not it's relevant and should be given or not, and protecting the family, I guess, versus the public's interest in having a person prosecuted with regard to serious crimes, as Ms. Tuttle was talking about. So I think that that's really maybe goes more to what you're saying, Senator Prusansky, about whether or not the privilege should be established with regard to, I guess, that situation.
Yes, I guess the only thing is, one thing that concerned me with what you just stated is that you believe, or maybe your experience in Clackamas County, that judges are actually taking and weighing, balancing under 403, I assume, as to whether or not a parent is going to be required to testify against a child. I've done 20 years of prosecution work, and I've never seen a court balance that test as compared to whether there was a right for a privilege or not.
No. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not talking about that they're balancing that, but it's just that judges, you know, normally are making these types of decisions with regard to evidence and other privileges, and whether or not other privileges apply. So I guess when we were talking about Mr. Zanashi was testifying, he's saying that the reason that they want to establish the privilege is because to protect the family. A dynamic with regard to parents and children, and children being able to come and talk to their parents. Well, you know, and as Ms. Tuttle indicated, you know, she's a parent. Children will come and talk to their parents, but we also have a public policy consideration with regard to serious crime that's committed in our community. And if someone goes and murders somebody, and they come, and the only person that they might confess to is in fact the parent, then that confession is important with regard to the prosecution.
Any question?
Well, I guess I'll throw it out there. It seems like the hook's been set. So under that analysis, if the child goes to the teacher or goes to their counselor, where it would be protected under the privileges, that seems to be some greater relationship than the parent and the child?
Well, actually, Senator Prusansky, with regard to those other privileges, you know, they don't always necessarily apply, as you well know, and there would be arguments given from both sides, and the judge would make a determination about whether or not the privilege will apply or not, and that's where the balancing test comes in. And then, I mean, of course, there's case law on this, and I'm not versed enough right now to start talking about that, but that's more the situation I'm talking about. The check and balance on these privileges is the judicial branch of government right now, and I think that you're going a long way if you're the legislative branch is going to establish, you know, a privilege that's going to tie the hands of prosecutors that have to prosecute very serious crimes, and you're going to limit that particular evidence. I mean, they always talk about how a trial is supposed to be a search for the truth. Well, it's, I guess, a search for the truth with regard to the rules that we have. And if, you know, the only confession to the crime is to a parent, that's significant, especially if it's a serious case.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Obviously, Senator Prusansky is getting amendments drafted, working with DHS, and he may want to work with both of you as to alleviate your concerns before going forward. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing. And Senator Berg, you want to move the last bill to tomorrow? So Senate Bill 347 and Senate Bill 536 will be moved till tomorrow's committee time, and then we finish the agenda for the day. Thank you, Senator Burdick, and thank you all for being here, and judiciary is adjourned.